Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. While there's a lot of criticism that America is not performing as well in the world of science as many would hope, it's time to take note of successes, and we need to look no further than Washington University, where four genomic researchers have been named among the 21 hottest in the world, including the man at the top of the list. The entire nation of China produced only four of the 21. The list was put together by the scientific and scholarly research organization Thomson Reuters. Joining me in studio, the researcher at the top of that hottest list, Professor Richard Wilson, director of the Genome Institute at Washington University, and Professor Li Ding, who heads the Genomics Medical Group at the Institute. Also on the hot list but unable to be with us are their colleagues at the Institute, Elaine Martis and Robert Fulton. We'll be joined a little bit later by Chris King, editor-analyst at Thomson Reuters Science Watch, the author of The Hottest Researchers and Research Papers. Li and Rick, so nice to have you with us, and congratulations.
Thank you.
What a wonderful honor. Worldwide, four of them right from our own institution, Washington University. You've got to be very, very proud.
Pretty excited. I think the best thing about it is it's a sort of a nice salute to the work we've been doing for the past dozen years or so. Of course, it goes way back before that, but we made a very conscious decision about 10, 12 years ago, since we were one of the only genome centers in the United States that was really embedded within a medical school, that we ought to take advantage of the work we were doing and the clinical space that surrounded us, and to really try to move this into the realm of using genomics to better understand human disease. And I think we've been successful.
I was going to say, what is the advantage of having it associated with a medical school? But when you're dealing with the disease, that's the place to be, I suppose.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And Li Ding, congratulations to you. I mentioned in my introduction that four researchers were from your home country, China. And of course, you're from China as well. So that brings to five the number who are involved. Tell us something about the work that you're doing over at the Institute.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say I'm very excited about this honor, and this really showed that the power of teamwork, because four scientists from the Genome Institute are among the top 21. So clearly this is shows the leadership of the Genome Institute from Dr. Richard K. Wilson. And also, like Rick mentioned earlier, we focus on important aspects of genomics research, including cancer genomics research, that really helped us to advance our this field. And in terms of to be on the list, and again, I'm very excited, and four Chinese scientists are also among the top 21, and that's something we are all very proud of.
No doubt you are. What specifically is the work that you're doing?
So I'm focusing on two major aspects. My group works on developing computational tools that are required for understanding the cancer genomes. That's number one. Number two, we are also focusing on discovering the genetic alterations, including acquired and inherited alterations responsible for the cancer initiation, progression, and relapse.
Is there ultimately a cure for cancer in the work that you're doing?
Eventually, yes, but there is no magic bullet. I believe that this requires teamwork, and there is no one solution for curing all cancers, but with the collective work from a group of people here and people worldwide, I think we will develop multiple approaches to cure cancer.
And Rick, what specifically are you looking at?
Well, it's my focus is the application of this genomics technology that we've helped develop and helped mature to really all human disease. The area that Li just described for you has been really a major focus for us over the last decade. And it's been a bit easier to apply genomic science. So just for listeners that might not know, genomics is essentially the study of all of our genes, our DNA, that's contained within pretty much every cell in our bodies. And what we're interested in is what might go wrong with that DNA in any particular person or any particular tumor type, and how does that cause disease? And what might we learn from a particular patient's DNA that could help us, you know, better diagnose or better treat their disease. Cancer has sort of been in the sweet spot of the technology that we have our hands on currently. For every cancer patient, there's a built-in control experiment, their normal DNA. So, for example, in a lung cancer patient, we'll study the DNA that we can purify away from some of their tumor cells, but we'll also look at DNA from their normal cells. And we're basically looking at the differences between normal genome and tumor genome and saying, aha, here are 12 mutations in genes. And we have some understanding based on the Human Genome Project that we spent 10 years before this doing as to how those genes might be relevant to their particular disease.
And your other colleagues who are not here today, Elaine Martis and Robert Fulton, what is their area? What were they cited for?
Well, all four of us have been very heavily involved in cancer genomics over the last decade. And I think the reason that we shared several of these hot papers is because we're all working on those projects. We all have some slightly different interests as well. So we still study the genomes of other animals. We've sequenced the genomes of quite a few primates, for example. And that's particularly useful because it helps us understand human biology better than if we simply looked at human DNA. So we all play a bit of a role in that as well. We're starting to take genomics to what we call complex diseases, not to suggest cancer is not a complex disease. But we have a big project just underway to look at the genetics of Alzheimer's disease. We've looked at diabetes and several other of these sort of complex disease. These are much tougher to study because there's not necessarily a built-in normal. You have to look at the genomes of tens and 20,000 people that both have disease and don't have the disease as a control.
And Li Ding, I guess you're the one to answer this question. Cancer is even more complicated than most because it's not a single disease. Cancer is a series of diseases, is it not?
That's right. There are hundreds of different types of cancers. So this is a great segue. So when you look at a cancer individually, different cancer types, you find the different genes that are mutated in different cancer types. But you also often find the same gene mutated in different cancer types. So there are commonalities and differences across different cancers.
Commonalities, and that's useful because that will help you, I suppose, in understanding all of them, ultimately.
Yes, and but understanding the unique features for each cancer type is also important for developing targeted therapy.
And is there a, what's the word I'm looking for, a predictive quality to all of this? In other words, once will we reach the point where we can take someone's DNA and say they're most likely to have cancer at some point?
So we're just starting to dabble in that. When we talk about cancer, we talk about somatic changes and inherited changes. Lee, I think, mentioned this a little bit earlier. There's much talk recently about breast cancer testing, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes.
Sure.
A person that has a family history of breast cancer can actually have that test. The aim of that test is to give you some idea of your built-in, your inherited risk for developing breast cancer. And this is still a bit controversial in terms of what a positive result actually means. What we've tended to focus on more in the last several years is somatic differences, the mutations that we acquire over the course of our life because we were exposed to some mutagen, some carcinogen, sunlight, cigarette smoke, what have you, that actually cause changes as our bodies age and experience the environment.
On the basis of what you've learned so far, and I understand that genomics is really in the very earliest stages of research. It's really at the dawn of this whole research. On the basis of what you do know, I'm curious as to whether you think Angelina Jolie did the right thing.
That's a really tough question. It's a personal choice. My view is that with the advancement of genomic technology, now she can make informed decision for herself. I think that's the key point. Different people will make different decisions based on the same information. but I believe that's the power to people. And just to add a little bit onto the inherited aspect of cancer, and Rick mentioned we have been focusing on somatic changes, which you acquire later during the development of cancer. But inherited components are also very important for the development of cancer, and we are shifting emphasis on this aspect.
Go ahead, Rick.
Oh, I was just going to say, going back to your original question, Don, I think as we continue to pursue some of these large cancer genomics projects, which we have several going on, we'll start to learn more and more about these inherited risks. And I think we probably get to a point someday where we actually can test people when they're very young and say, you know, you have an increased risk for colon cancer. Mm-hmm. If your family physician is armed with that information, right? Right now, the standard is when you hit 50, you'll have your colonoscopy, joyful experience. But for somebody that has an increased risk of colorectal cancer, they might start their colonoscopy screening at age 30, for example.
Yeah. The same for ovarian cancer and breast cancer.
Right. What sort of coordination is there amongst researchers worldwide? I understand you work as a team, and I'm sure it's a very closely knit unit. But you may be doing the same thing that someone in China is doing or someone is doing in Hungary. How do you know what they're doing, or do you? And if you do, how do you work together?
So actually, there are two major consortiums for cancer work. One is the Cancer Genome Atlas within the U.S., TCGA. The other consortium is ICGC, International Cancer Genome Consortium. We have been communicating frequently among us to coordinate efforts and so on.
And the other measure is the reason that you're having us here on your show today is that when we do research projects and we interpret the data and we put together the findings, we write papers. The papers are peer-reviewed and they appear in journals. And if we've really said something, if we've really had a good result, those papers are read and cited by other people who are working in the field. And that's how you know, who's doing what. So as Lee can tell you, we get hundreds of emails every week from other researchers who want to better understand a particular aspect of something that we've done, would like to have some of our data, or might even like to collaborate going forward.
And how willing are you to share what might be considered proprietary information that you've discovered here with these folks?
At Washington University, at the Genome Institute, our work is funded by your tax dollars. This is almost everything we do is with federal funds, although we do also have some private funds. But an understanding of that, receiving that type of funding, is that you put your data out there so that the community can build upon it. And again, that's sort of a measure of why we're hot researchers, right, is because a lot of people have cited that work and moved on with it.
Well, as I said before we went on the air, when I heard that I was going to be talking to the world's hottest researchers here in studio today, I thought you'd have a calendar or something. Maybe that is to come at some point. I think Judy Martin of your staff thinks that is maybe not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. I'm only kidding, of course. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. With me is Professor Richard Wilson, Director of the Genome Institute at Washington University. Professor Lee Ding, who heads the Genomics Medical Group at the Institute, is also with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Chris King, who is the man from Thomson Reuters Science Watch, who is the author of the hottest researchers and research papers. We'll also take your calls, and we have Kristen waiting in Imperial. Kristen, I'll get to you. Don't go away. I think you have an important question to ask. We'll do that when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation about the world's 21 hottest researchers, and four of those named, and these are hottest researchers worldwide, by the way, four of those named are from our own Washington University. I have two of them with me in studio, Professor Rick Wilson, Director of the Genome Institute at Washington University, and Professor Lee Ding, who heads the Genomics Medical Group at the Institute. Joining us now by phone from Philadelphia is Chris King of Thomson Reuters Science Watch. He's the author of the hottest researchers and research papers. And Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about this project, how it got started, why it got started, and some of the things that surprised you and your findings.
Well, it basically derives from the Thomson Reuters database. Our database called the Web of Science indexes the contents of something like 11,000 journals, scholarly scientific publications, that sort of thing. So we basically know what's being published. We decided to look at a slightly different aspect, as Dr. Wilson has already alluded. When scientists write papers, sort of a central moire or convention is that you acknowledge your sources. You cite the previous work that you are maybe carrying forward or taking off on a tangent, but you must acknowledge your sources, your intellectual debts. And in tallying up these citations, one can get a very clear idea about what the most influential scientists are. And again, it has the virtue of reflecting the judgments that scientists themselves make. So perhaps that's the most noteworthy thing about this undertaking, is it's not our selection of hot scientists. It reflects the judgments of their peers, of the scientific community itself.
I find it interesting that 8 of the 21 researchers cited are in the field of genomics. That surprise you?
No, it's been very active. Obviously, the Human Genome Project made a big splash. It's a very active field. A lot of people are researching, writing papers. And again, as Dr. Wilson has mentioned, questions just seem to be get more questions, and the levels of complexity keep getting deeper. So it's a very active field.
What are some of the other areas that you found with regard specifically to the hot papers?
General materials research is hot. A substance called graphene, that's a form of carbon that's very thin but has a lot of very strong and is being explored and applied in numerous different kinds of applications, even stuff like biomedicine for drug delivery, that sort of thing. Obviously, cardiology is a very key field, so some of the scientists are involved in cardiology or epidemiology, tracking disease, burden, disease occurrence, that sort of thing. Just general biostatistics, writing about the dimensions of disease and where it's occurring, that sort of thing.
I see that alternative energy is also on the list.
Yes, polymer solar cells, that's another very hot field. Basing the solar cells on these polymers. I guess silicon is actually at the moment a more commercially viable or commercially established technology, but there's a lot of work on polymer solar cells that is expected to lead eventually to different forms of energy, actually flexible solar cells, that sort of thing. One of the scientists involved was involved in a project of providing lights that could be used in remote areas in Africa, so the Lighting Africa Initiative, I think it was called. So that's another very exciting field.
And obesity is another one that kind of caught my eye, given all the attention that is being given to that particular problem, particularly among young people in this country.
Sure. Yeah, obviously a huge problem just in recent years, the rates of obesity, diabetes, that sort of thing. So obviously, yes, that is also garnering huge attention.
How did you go about rating these, both the papers and the people?
Well, again, it's not our selection as much as it reflects the work that is judged by the scientific community to be noteworthy and of value and of significance in their own work. We have a subset of our Web of Science. It's called the Hot Papers Database, and that will in effect tell us what comparatively recent work, say, the last 2 years or so, what recent works are being highly cited kind of right now. So it's monitoring in as close to real time as possible what works are being cited at a level that is higher than, say, a comparable paper that came out in the same journal at the same time. And that's what we did with our survey here with identifying the hot researchers. We looked at recent papers that were particularly hot during 2012. So that's where Dr. Wilson and his colleagues really distinguished themselves in terms of having numerous reports that met this threshold of being cited at a level markedly above papers of comparable type and age in their respective fields.
Another thing that caught my eye, and certainly the eye of others, is the fact there are only two women on the list, both of them at Washington University, and one of them is sitting right here in front of me.
Yes, yes. We've had women on the list in the past, but obviously there's room for more, and that's something we hope to see.
Let me ask, Li Ding, let me ask you about that. I mean, obviously this compounds the honor, I'm sure, for you. Why so few women?
I think this is changing. I think more and more women are studying biology and other scientific majors. And I do expect that the number of or the proportion of women on the list will increase in the future. And I want to say that with both Dr. Elin Modest and myself on the list, it really shows that the Genome Institute is a strong supporter of advancement of women in science. And also, today, you cannot accomplish a goal by yourself in science anymore. We rely on teamwork. My team consists of both women and men scientists. So I think the teamwork really made us to be on the top of the list.
Rick, same question to you with regard to the number of women who are involved in this particular science. It's growing. It has to be growing. Your thoughts about that and how it's advancing?
Well, the trend is in the positive direction, as Lee mentions. Chris can correct me if I'm mistaken, but I don't think in the last two of these indexes there were any women. Chris, is that right?
I'm trying to think. I don't believe in the last couple. I don't know offhand. I should, but I'll check on
so,
that.
So I think this is the trend, and this is it reflects what we're seeing in the field is that more and more women are becoming key researchers. Lee is relatively early in her career. She's just become a tenure track assistant professor at WashU, and you know she's had influential papers because she's terrific at what she does. I expect that we're going to see this trend continue. There should be four next year.
Well, that's what you're predicting.
Well, Chris, you're going to do this again next year?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, it's been a feature since about 1993. Yeah. So we'll hope for more women scientists.
This would have to increase. There are more women going to college these days. There are more women graduating from college than men. But, you know, one of the big problems in our country today, at least it's been talked about a lot lately, are the STEM disciplines, the science, technology, engineering, and math disciplines that we seem to be lacking in this country. And neither male nor female students are really taking up these disciplines. You're nodding your head very much along with this, Rick. What's going on here, and do you sense that it's changing at all?
Well, I'm worried because my perspective on this is at a point relatively late in a scientific career where I worry about opportunities in high-level research. One of the things that's scary to us is that the NIH budget has essentially been flat for several years now. And we see that young investigators, are both men and women, are having a harder time getting their first grants. I'm afraid that, you know, undergraduate students who get a taste of this from dabbling in research, you know, at their various universities – start to think, well, maybe I should just go to med school. There certainly won't be, a shortage in the need for doctors. It doesn't seem like maybe a career in scientific research is going to be a good place to go. And it all rolls downhill back down to the K-12 programs as well.
Chris King, you have the thoughts about this?
I was actually checking on women scientists. You'll have to forgive. We did have one in the last 2 years. There was a researcher from Decode Genetics in Iceland. But otherwise, I think Rick is correct. There's been a paucity, and we need more.
Well, he's given you an assignment to have four four next year. So
I will do my utmost.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Li Ding, let me come back to you with regard to students in this country. Do not seem to take to the science disciplines very well. In China, it's quite different. Is it not?
And when I was in China, science is really one of the hot major. And I liked math, physics, since I was a little girl. So it was very natural for me to get into biology. And I also agree with you that in China, people pay close attention to science, and we are encouraged to pursue scientific career.
Encouraged by whom?
By parents, by laborers, by teachers, everybody.
Rick, that's where we're lacking here then.
I think so. I think, you know, a large part of it is that science isn't necessarily believed to be cool. And I think when you go to China, I went on a trip a couple of years ago, and, you know, there is a lot of encouragement, and science is seen as a major contributor to society. And it's not just in China. It's in many other countries. You know, I think about when I grew up, I was interested in science from the time I was in second or third grade. And people said, well, why do you want to do that? That's not interesting. That's boring. You're not going to make a great contribution. And, you know, I said, well, geez, I want to cure cancer. Mm-hmm. That was my goal from when I was a little kid. So I think if more people thought about that and how fabulous an impact it can have on a country like the U.S.,
but you,
maybe that changes it.
You had probably Mr. Wizard on television when you were growing up. And I want to make a point about that. You don't find that anymore. I mean, there was a time when you could turn on the television set as a youngster and really be introduced to some things that just not available to them now.
Absolutely right.
Absolutely. All right, Chris, have you given that any thought now with regard to the STEM disciplines here?
Forgive me. What was the angle again?
That youngsters here do not seem to be encouraged nor inclined to study the sciences, the STEM sciences. Science,
right.
Technology, engineering, math, that sort of thing.
I too have seen the reports about, you know, how dismally we tend to make out in terms of science education. And obviously it's something that needs to be fostered and as Rick would say, made cool.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more question before we let you go. I know your time here is limited. I gather from the material that you're assembling and have been assembling that you would use this to forecast future breakthroughs. Is that correct?
It's a bit tricky because citations are sort of by their nature you're sort of looking back. It's a measure of acclimation of work that's already been done. But, I would say that we could continue to see heavy activity in genomics, and one would hope that before too long we will be heralding Dr. Wilson as the cure of cancer, perhaps in this venue. But, obviously work in that vein will continue.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the amount of work you did, obviously, to put this list together, and we appreciate your spending some time with us.
Okay, thanks very much for having me.
That's Chris King of Thomson Reuters Science Watch. He's the author of the hottest researchers and research papers about which we are talking about on today's program. We have a call from Imperial. Kristen has been waiting patiently. Let's bring her into the conversation. Chris, thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess the best way to ask the question is to just kind of give you some information. So my family, going back many, many generations, originally they called it a wasting disease, but now we know it's early onset chronic progressive multiple sclerosis. So the evidence would suggest that there is some sort of genetic predisposition or link to this particular disease. Seeing the effects of it on my uncle, I would want to do anything that I could to further research in this particular area. Do you know if there's a way that people like me with, you know, various familial histories of these types of diseases, where can we go to, I guess, donate our genetic information to help out, I guess?
So this is where Google is your friend. And it's pretty amazing because I think one other common type of email communication that Lee and I and our colleagues see quite often are from folks like yourself who have loved one with a particular disease, and they're trying to learn more. And you know, I think there is great promise in genomics for dealing with some of these more rare diseases. So the key thing is to hit Google and to find and identify NIH-sponsored studies in the particular disease of interest. More and more, the folks that are doing these diseases, they essentially are starting out by identifying families and trying to understand some of the basic characteristics of family history, some of the basics of the disease physiology. And this sort of leads to studies. Eventually, they ring up the genomics folks like ourselves. And then we can get involved as they start to learn more and more about the disease. So that's your first best place to start, Kristen, is internet research. I'm guessing you probably have already done some of this. But if you can find an NIH study and a NIH institute that has some focus on that disease, that's really your best bet.
Thank you.
Kristen, thanks so much for the call. Before I take the break, you really have to be careful, though. I'm using the internet for a lot of this information because you specify the NIH mm-hmm. studies. I suppose that's because there are probably a lot of fly-by-night operations out there that might have inaccurate or damaging, potentially, information.
Well, it is why I mentioned NIH. I mean, you can't get an NIH grant unless you have some bona fide credentials, and you do this through your academic institution or through I mean, there are plenty of commercial entities, pharma companies or biotech mm-hmm. companies, that are certainly legitimate and are focused on drug development and test development and so forth. But that's why I mentioned NIH, because it's really the best place to start.
This testing is very expensive, from what I understand. I think most recently with the Angelina Jolie thing, a lot of people are excluded from that kind of testing because it is expensive. Mm-hmm. Is the price likely to come down as this research continues? Lee, you're shaking your head. You think so?
Yes, the price is coming down drastically. Yes.
And that will be helpful to everyone involved. I've got to take another break, and I want to encourage more calls as we continue our conversation on the world's 21 hottest researchers. I have two of them in the room with me here, and we have four of them at Washington University. This is worldwide, folks. This is a big deal. Four of the hottest researchers in the world are at Washington University. Come back and continue that conversation, but I'd like to get you into it at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Come on in. Back in just a moment with Professor Richard Wilson and Professor Lee Ding of Washington University in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we are continuing our conversation. It's basically focused on the fact that a recent survey, if you will, has indicated that 21 of the hottest research scientists and papers in the world, the producers of papers in the world on scientific research, there are four of those are at Washington University, two of them with me in studio, Professor Richard Wilson, director of the Genome Institute at Washington University, and also from the Institute at WashU is Professor Lee Ding. I want to get back to the issue of Alzheimer's, which you mentioned a little while ago, Rick. You're just starting some work on that. A lot of folks are looking at the if you will, the genetic predisposition to that. Where are you in this kind of research?
Very early on, and I would say I'm motivated because my father actually has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, so it's an up-close and personal thing for me. There has been some good initial work in AD. In fact, a couple colleagues at Washington University actually have helped find some of the key genes that are a bit indicative of Alzheimer's disease. So in one way, for some forms of Alzheimer's, we have the beginnings of a risk assessment test that might become a little bit more widespread in the future. But it doesn't explain all of Alzheimer's disease. I think there's still some genetic dark matter, if you will, that we're trying to understand. So the administration 2 years ago decided that there should be a national Alzheimer's disease initiative focused on genetics. And the mission came to the three NIH-funded large genome centers, of which we were one. to begin some sort of applications of this new genomics technology to try to better understand. So what we've done so far is to identify study participants, and we're coming at this from two very interesting perspectives. So we have the usual what's termed as a cases and control study, where you have people with the disease and you look at their genomes, and people without the disease, and you try to understand the differences. And it all boils down to doing really good statistical work. But AD also tends to run in some families. And so what we've done is to design a study where we actually are going to use affected and unaffected members of the of some of these families to try to get some idea of what might have gone wrong or what they might have inherited that contributes to their disease. And this is just underway.
What an important area this is, given what's going on in this country and around the world today.
Absolutely. There's a huge cost to the treatment of these patients.
Yeah, I had that figure in a program we did a couple of weeks ago. I've since forgotten it, of course, but it's an enormous
billions.
Figure. Absolutely in the billions, yeah. And Li Ding, with your research you're doing in cancer, can you tell me something that you've learned through that research that is most promising in your eyes?
There are a number of things. I think right now we are still mostly in the so-called discovery phase. So meaning we sequence and analyze thousands of tumor samples and try to understand the underlying genetic causes of cancer. So we have made tremendous progress on this.
Where do you get this matter that you're studying, the DNA, the tumors? Where does it come from?
So from hospitals. So we have, so scientists, like I mentioned about the Cancer Genome Atlas program earlier during the show. And this is a joint program across the country. And this effort is trying to collect samples from 20 major cancer types. For each cancer type, we aim to collect at least 500 cases to better understand the genetic alterations in each cancer type and across the all 20 major cancer types. So again, teamwork, group effort. People work on different aspects of this project, collecting samples by communicating with different hospitals and then have the institute working on processing the samples, then having the genome sequencing centers performing the sequencing and analysis, then produce papers.
Wow, it sounds so intense and complicated. How many people do you have at the institute, Rick?
I believe we're around 200.
Wow. Let's go back to the phones. It's just stunning to think of this kind of work going on here and how many people it takes to get the job done. Let's bring in Bruce. He's been waiting. Bruce, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, how long do you think it'll be before this gene testing is accurate enough to replace the common blood testing that you would get in a normal physical? I'm thinking maybe for something like colon cancer, where there is a definitive intervention that can be done. Gene testing makes perfect sense, but Alzheimer's, maybe not so much. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, it all depends on the test, the disease, the gene involved, the way you have to look at that gene in terms of what the cost is or what the accuracy is. I can tell you that right now, the standard of care for diagnosis of a new lung cancer patient involves a careful collection of a family history. You'd like to know if a patient has lung cancer in their family, for example, but you'd also like to know the smoking status. And for patients who report that they've not been smokers, quite often there's a gene mutation involved, a gene that we call EGFR. And if there is a mutation in that gene, and we can test very accurately now for that particular mutation, if there is a mutation, there's a targeted therapy that has much lower side effects than standard chemotherapy. And quite often, patients who go on that drug do quite well. And we're starting to see more and more examples of this. So I think, you know, gene-by-gene testing is very commonplace. You typically wouldn't use blood for it. You would like to have some tumor material, so a biopsy might have already been done. But one of the things that we're actually working on is to simply be able to detect what we call circulating tumor cells or circulating tumor DNA from a blood sample. And I think we have to get our technology a bit more sensitive. But things like that are very possible. And again, it depends on the disease and what exactly we're looking for, you know, in a patient's DNA. But for some of that, accuracy is already there. And for some of that, cost is already reasonable. And I think we'll just see more and more of this going forward.
Hope that answered your question. Let's bring in Adam. This time we'll take the call from Alton. Go ahead, Adam. Are you with us?
About how the number of students in the STEM disciplines lags in America over other industrialized nations. Where America really leads other industrialized nations is levels of religious affiliation and levels of religious belief. And I wonder if your panel there could comment on whether there's a correlation there, and also whether that might affect certain disciplines, STEM disciplines, more than others. For example, I might think that that would affect how America does in math and chemistry, and it might have much bigger effects on, for example, the teaching of biology, where a lot of high school teachers might be reluctant to talk about evolution.
I think it's an interesting theory, Adam. I haven't really thought much about that or taken a close look at it, but it could be.
We thank you for the call. Do you have any comment, Li Ding?
No, I think we're okay.
Let's turn to Tom calling from Belleville. Tom, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason our students aren't going into science and math is there are too many electronic distractions. While people are studying, they're going through the motions of studying, they're getting on Facebook, they're playing video games, and they're doing all sorts of other things. There's an emphasis in our schools on doing makeovers, on sports, and on socializing. There's a time for having fun, and there's a time for buckling down and studying. The students are not, they're going through the motions, but they're not actually studying. They think that they're going to go, they're going to pay their money for college, and they're going to slice and dice up a frog, and they're going to attend a certain number of classes, and write a certain number of reports. But when they finish college, their heads are empty. So they've got to control these electronic distractions and go and not go through the motions of study, but actually study.
Tom, thank you so much for the call. I'll bet you you're over 50 years old and maybe even older than that. Am I right? I guess his Tom is gone.
Yeah.
I think he just said yes. Does anyone want to get into this discussion with Tom? Okay, because I have an observation or two. I'll make. Go ahead, Li Ding.
Making study fun. That's what I try to do at home. My kids, they like video games and other things. But we try to make study fun, make math fun. For example, this website called Khan Academy. It's super fun for kids to learn math. And we also try to play certain games that useful for training kids' brain. For example, chess games and games they invent by themselves. I think if we can focus on making math, physics fun, and we will have more kids join the team.
Thoughts of Rick? You look like you might want to avoid this one.
I completely agree. I will skip any conversations about how much video gaming goes on at my house.
Well, you know, I asked, he made reference to his age because I think there was a generational thing going on. And I can remember going back a good number of years when everyone thought that television was going to be the destruction of the young world because they were spending too much time watching television. And even going back to radio, that too much time was being spent doing these kinds of things, the technology of the day. Well, this technology of our day, wonderful as it is, it's still in the very earliest stages. And, you know, the kids that are using this technology aren't dumb. Not by any stretch of the imagination. As a matter of fact, they're quite bright and have more access to information than ever before.
I'm very impressed. They understand computer better than I do.
Sure. You know, it's their world, and a lot of it that we older folks don't always understand. And I think maybe that's where Tom is coming from. With regard to, again, Rick, I'm going to go back to the Alzheimer's situation here. Are you looking for volunteers? I mean, you're talking about a large number of people that you're studying. How is that working, and do you need folks for that?
So absolutely. And I think if people are interested, I'm going to go back to my advice to the earlier caller. The National Institute of Aging, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, supports several studies by which folks can come to a number of different sites across the U.S., and volunteer to enter into one of these studies. They're all known by crazy acronyms like NIALOAD and CROD and CRAD or something like that. But they basically will determine if patients and their family members are good study participants. We'll take some blood, might do some neurological studies just to understand the exact description of each particular patient. And those are all candidates for the genomic studies that we're just starting.
Is there a central place to go? I mean, could we go to your website? I assume the Genomics Institute has a website.
Well, you could we do have a website, genome.wustel.edu. But you can also Google for the Hope Center at Washington University. Mm-hmm. Dr. Allison Goat, a colleague at WashU, is involved in some of these studies and actually has enrolled a number of patients in the studies.
Okay, we'll get those on our website at stlpublicradio.org. How about you, Lee Ding? Do you need people to help you with your research?
Oh, absolutely. Just like Rick said, we are actively enrolling patients into our study. So, again, going through the same website and try to reach us through those channels.
Yep. For cancer, it's the Siteman Cancer Center.
Okay.
And there's been a terrific job of opening new studies where almost every cancer patient that comes into the Siteman now and is diagnosed is given an opportunity to enroll in a study where their tumor and blood may be used for these types of investigations.
We only have a little over a minute left, and I want to go back to an issue we talked about earlier, and that is the sharing of information, collaboration, and what have you. And it seems to me that this might be difficult with some institutions in some countries with which we may not be very, very friendly. Do we have any problem dealing with countries like that?
Not really, because all scientists are essentially driven by the need and desire to publish their work. It's how a new professor gets tenure at their prospective university. It's how an investigator gets additional grants. You need to publish, and you want to try to publish work that is citable and hence makes a difference in the field.
So we might not have any problem dealing with the scientific communities in North Korea or Iran at the present time.
Well, I can't say much about cancer research, for example, in North Korea. But I can tell you that, people in countries like Iran constantly send us email wanting to better understand the work we've done and tell us about their work.
Glad to hear that as well. We're going to have to stop it there. I want to thank you so much, Professor Wilson, for being with us. Professor Lee Ding, thank you so much for being with us. And congratulations once again on the fine honor that has been bestowed upon you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Two of the 21 hottest science researchers in the world. Thank you. We have to say goodbye. Join St. Louis Public Radio online in just a couple of minutes from noon to 1 p.m. We'll have a live chat about an opinion piece about St. Louis and the Midwest, which appeared in the New York Times over the weekend. How do you think the Gateway City is viewed and portrayed on the national level? Participate in our live discussion. Go to stlpublicradio.org. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about programs in the St. Louis region to help high school students make a successful transition to higher education and to obtain a degree. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.